Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. 2023 has been a bizarre experience for me. The majority of you all that currently listen to the show did not know who I was a year ago. And it wasn't because I just started this show a year ago. It's because, the algorithm that runs all of the social media stuff and all of the everything on the internet just randomly just chose my number this year. I have no idea why. But 1 year ago today, 12 months ago, the number of people that listened to my show, the number of people that followed me on social media was just infinitesimally smaller than it is now. I've had the highest highs of my life and some of the lowest lows of my life kind of off camera this year. 2023 has been a big year, not just for me, but for everybody. And it's time for it to die. It is time for us to build the funeral pyre and stick 2023 on it and burn it down and for a few days just pray to anybody that's listening that 2024 is better. I know we've got a lot of stuff coming up in 2024, and it's probably going to get a lot worse, but who knows? It's the time of year when you get to live in hope. So I brought on dear friend of mine, friend of the show, fellow author, Meg Ellison. You know her from Number One Fan. You know her from Find Layla. You know her from the Road to Nowhere trilogy. You know her from her sexy selfies on Instagram. I invited Meg Ellison back onto the show to just kind of count down the highs and lows of the year. We get into a lot of author drama. like take whatever amount of author drama you think you're about to hear and just ramp that up to 10, because there has been an inordinate amount of book drama. So if you're a weird nerd, you're going to like the show. Anyways, Meg Ellison is coming back on the show today to count it down. It's a fun kind of thing to put on in the background. Enjoy. Here is me and Meg Ellison. Hi, Meg Ellison. Welcome back to Head on Fire.
Hi, Dawn. I'm very glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming back. Folks who do not know, Meg Ellison has become one of my nearest and dearest friends over the recent years. But if you do not know her, Meg, please introduce yourself. Who are you and what do you do?
My name is Meg Ellison. I'm an author primarily of science fiction, but also of horror, fantasy, and thrillers. I write novels and short stories. I have a short story collection, and you can find out about all of my work at megellison.com.
This is a fun show because I'm not really interviewing you specifically about your work. We are here to burn 2023 to the ground. So for the last show of the year, I thought it would be kind of fun to, just to spitball, just to talk about the highs, the lows of 2023. We also grabbed some really cool questions from some listeners and followers on social media. It's just a cool, fun, casual show, you guys. Something to kind of put on in the background, get drunk, get hammered, and light 2023 on fire with us.
With the heat of these opinions, with the heat of these takes.
The hottest of takes.
Yes.
We should probably start right up top with what were your favorite books of 2023? And I would just like it noted, Meg Ellison is out there saving me from myself, because I originally wanted to also talk about my least favorite books of the year. And Meg said, you can't do that. So I just want you to know, I was fully prepared to drag some books, but I'm not going to, because Meg is nicer than me. So what were your top three favorite books of the year?
So you don't do that anymore once you're a professional. That's the point I was trying to make. It's not considered polite. You wouldn't want somebody to do that to you. Okay. I have so many favorite books from this year, and it's really been hard to narrow them down. So my favorite reads this year have been Yellowface by R.F. Kuang, which is like a modern send-up of the publishing industry.
Too.
I figured it's on your list, too. We can definitely talk about it. Whalefall by Daniel Krauss, which is one of the best thrillers I've ever read. It's already been optioned to be a movie, and it should absolutely be a movie. The Devil Takes You Home by Gabino Iglesias. It won the Stoker this year, and it is a great horror novel. Truly great. This is not a new book, but I just happened to discover Possession by S.A. Byatt this year. Possession is like a really early entry into the genre we now refer to as dark academia. It's like a slow burn about two long dead English poets. It's got all these invented letters between these invented poets. It's incredibly romantic. And S.A. Byatt just died this year, so I felt very touched that I happened to discover her work right there at the end. Also not a new book, but I read Bee Season by Myla Goldberg, which was made into a really not great movie featuring Richard Gere, but the book is fantastic.
Yeah, we are definitely going to talk about Yellowface, especially given all of the book drama in the last like week.
Coming in under the wire, some great book drama at the end.
There's like Yellowface come to life. Oh my gosh. Okay, for me, my books kind of spanned different genres, of course. Legends and Lattes was this very cozy fantasy novel, kind of set in a Dungeons and Dragons style verse. It's very cozy. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world, and it was just really nice to read something cozy and inviting where not a lot of terrible things happen. It's been a good year for memoir.
It really has.
I have to say, the Britney Spears memoir, I don't remember who her ghostwriter was.
I almost put Maggie Smith's memoir on my list because it was so mind-blowingly good.
Oddly enough, I have read all of her poetry collections. I have not read her memoir, and I hear it's wonderful.
It's great. It's absolutely worth your time. You should.
Speaking of poets, I read Lord of the Butterflies by Andrea Gibson.
Yes, you loved that book. You talked to me about it so many times.
I have talked about that book so many times, and then I talked about it on social media and sold it out worldwide. And got a thank you note from Andrea Gibson.
Oh, nice. Good job.
Let's see. The only other thing that I really kind of want to shout out, The Honeys by Ryan LaSala. He's also become a friend of mine, but I will say The Honeys is legitimately very, very, very good. It is dark, it's creepy, it's horror, it's gay, it's very, very, very gay. It's what if Clueless and The Craft had happened in the same high school and they all went to summer camp.
That sounds great.
It's a really good time. Okay, Yellowface. This is actually kind of a theme that a lot of our submitted questions are kind of about. I'm an author, but you're like an author. Like, you've been in this world way longer than I have. You have been an author long enough to see this kind of transition from behind the page to in front of the camera for authors.
Yes.
My first traditional pub came out in 2021. So I don't know what it was like in 2011. Did publishers never have a marketing budget for us? Were we always supposed to be marketers of one?
No, I think that has fractured over time, both with the expectation that online marketing is free, first of all, and second of all, the only thing that really matters. So the budget that used to be put into one or two books a year to get it into airports and to get people to talk about it on Letterman or whatever has now been fractured into 20 or 30 books a year, and they still get into airports and they sometimes do print ads, but there are more books now being published by more people than ever. And I think that's a net good. I think that's great. But I think that and the overall fracturing of the markets and the ways that we get books, the places that we get books, has really thrown publishing. I mean, once you're on the inside, you start to realize that publishing as an industry has not really changed in like 50 years. There are some practices in publishing that people on the outside are like, how is that legal? How do they do that? Many authors receive royalty statements that do not explain how many copies of their book they sold or in what format or in what language or in what market. They just send you a check and tell you to trust them. And a lot of it is like that. A lot of it is desperately opaque, really outdated, running 6 months to 2 years behind the actual sales. So when you look at how it plays into marketing, it is, of course, just as opaque. It is just as confusing. And it's just as balanced against the sole creator, as we are named in our contracts, of the work.
I mention all of that to lay the groundwork for the fact that authors have had to become influencers. A lot of us kind of against our will. I already had a platform and I already, you know, I did this podcast, so I was kind of set up a little better for it. But most authors just want to be writing our little stories and tippy-tapping on our computer. And we take one photo. It's the author photo. It's right here. It's in black and white.
Until it's laughably outdated.
Sometimes that's the only time you're like, oh, that's who wrote all these books? There's so few people that aren't just household names, but like you would recognize them on the street. I can think of like Neil Gaiman, Stephen King, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Even when Stephen King was the number one selling author in America in the 1980s, he said he had no problem going anywhere. He did not get recognized in public. He had a photo in the book jacket and the photos were good. And still people didn't stop him when he was out for dinner. He said that the difference was he did an ad for American Express in like 1990 and it was their old don't leave home without it, you know? And he's like in a creepy castle and he's got like a raven on his shoulder and it's all very Vincent Price. And he said that was what pushed him into recognizability. He could not walk down the street anymore. So his mistake was being an influencer.
I mean, it's a two-edged sword, man. I can get on social media. I can wave my book cover around and it pops up in the charts and it gets a little bump. And I continue to sell this little teeny tiny book that I thought wouldn't sell 2 years later. It's still on the Simon & Schuster table at Comic-Con. It's still a thing. It's still opening doors for me. And it was this little teeny tiny thing that did nothing. But the only reason it's still selling is because of social media. So, you know, social media is also giving us gifts of books that we absolutely did not know about, could not know about, absolutely flopped when they came out.
When we found out otherwise.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that social media has been good for my books, that I've had many, many bumps from Instagram, from TikTok. My book gets discussed on people's book review videos all the time. And I'm vain. I like posting Instagram photos and people telling me that I'm pretty and I'm clever. I like being clever on Blue Sky. I can churn out aphorisms with the best of them. The terrible part is that it's not an option. It's not, I can be clever when I feel like it. I can post pictures when
it's
I feel pretty. I have to create content all the time. It is an unpaid job that I do to push people toward my books on which I earn a percentage. Like it's not even, it is not in any way direct. And you know how that is. It does not come out the way you want.
It's an entire job. My mom earlier this year really kind of got to see like all the sides of it. She came for a visit and was like seeing like how much goes into all of this. And she's like, you just never stop working. It's like, no, I never stop working.
Everybody I know who's creative, everybody I know who writes books or makes music or does comics, like we're always working. We all have a 9-to-5 and we have a full-time career as an artist. And then there's all the stuff around that, like writing invoices and doing your own taxes and making content. Like we just work all the time.
Authors are having to become influencers. Authors are having to be on social media. They're having to have their faces shown a lot more. They're having to be in videos. They're having to suddenly become actors and they're having to write cute little scripts. And I do think that that creates a pressure cooker. It's just one extra layer of anxiety to give a bunch of introverts who would much rather be mostly anonymous people. But I wonder, did the kind of author drama that we're seeing, the sabotage, the going out of our way to be wildly racist and creating bad reviews.
Yeah.
Was that, I mean, I don't know. I was a baby in 2001. I wasn't in this world. I didn't know. We didn't have the internet. I grew up in a crap town where we had dial up still. I wasn't on the internet. Did this happen then? Did this exist?
I'm not that old. I have not been published that long. So my first book came out in 2014, by which time social media was definitely a thing. But I have heard from a lot of Gen X writers that no, it did not exist at the time. And if your publisher was going to ignore you in 2001, they would just ignore you. They wouldn't ask you like, do you know any bloggers who you could talk to? So it is like you said, it's a double-edged sword. Like it gives us democratic access to tools we might otherwise never see. And also it introduces us to the utter uselessness of trying to fight the algorithm for visibility. It is good and it is terrible.
Yeah. So we got to see some fun author drama. So if you like Yellowface, Yellowface is a white author stealing her dead Asian, I'm going to put air quotes here, friends. Frenemies. Manuscript words, passing them off as her own, and hijinks ensue. Every single author that I know, this is one of their favorite books of the year because it's just so, you know, these people, you've been in these rooms, you've been at that conference, you've talked to these people, you've seen all sides of, and then right at the tail end of the year, we got it in real life with Kate Corain.
The best thing about Yellowface was that R.F. Kuang was actually able to write about the kind of legitimate professional jealousy that all authors feel. We have these long cycles. We have these like 2-year cycles in which nothing is happening because somebody's editing your book, somebody's designing a cover, nothing. You just have to wait. You have to wait and you're mortal and it's terrible. And while you're waiting, and you're lucky to be waiting because you might be waiting to get an agent. You might be waiting to get a deal. So the best case scenario is you're waiting for your work to come out. And meantime, your friends, they announce new book deals. They announce that they won an award. They announce that they hit the list. And it feels like everybody else is on one of those moving sidewalks like they have at the airport, and you are dragging yourself along on your elbows. So Yellowface describes both being the object of that jealousy and burning in that jealousy. So when I saw what happened to Kate Corrane, I thought she must be so deeply insecure and she must be feeling that jealousy on such a hellish and unavoidable level that it drives her to do yet another unpaid job in creating sock puppet accounts so she could review bomb her fellow debuts. That is so desperately unhealthy. That is someone who cannot escape the worst thoughts they have about both themselves and their comrades. I cannot imagine the miserable psychosis that must exist inside a person to stir them to do that for months at a time, almost a year at a time. And I think that's the real genius of Yellowface, is R.F. Kuan was able to write about those feelings and how inescapable they are and how we are already predisposed to them when we become writers.
You know what's so funny is that Dabbler's Guide has now, you know, been out 2 years. So you start to feel that like,
I can't believe it's been that long.
It was like five haircuts ago. I've written like 3 other books since then.
Which is, if you're listening to this and you want to be a writer someday, that is extremely normal. Churning out books that are not ready to be published, that are underdeveloped.
I wrote a 180,000 word science fiction epic thing that is a really good idea. That needs so much editing. It's not even funny. That I wrote a rom-com for an agent. In fairness to her, she saw the romance bubble coming and she was like, we're only doing romance here, buddy. And then I wrote the novel that we're shopping and then part of a nonfic.
It is extremely common for authors to have a bunch of books that they're just sitting on. These are often referred to as trunked books because you keep them in a trunk, you don't throw them out, but they're not ready.
And you and your agent are talking about, okay, what do the next 5 years look like? Okay, this is the next thing. This is what we should be publishing next. But you feel that urge of you hear everyone else's books being released and you see that some people have a faster schedule than you and other people have a different schedule. And you're just like, to borrow you, I just want to be a god again.
I just want to be a god. That's
it. Oh, I just want to be talking about release dates and pre-orders. And then release day happens and nothing about your life changes. You've already made your money. You've already cashed that check. And nobody, most of us don't go out to, you know, throngs of screaming fans. We're all just like sitting in our house with a glass of Moscato and going, well, my book's on shelves somewhere.
Yeah, you have a very quiet launch day. And then that's one of the reasons I tell writers that they should do therapy. Like the impatience and the jealousy and the ability to deal with yourself when it is good and when it is bad. And to know that even when it's good, you're still you. Your regular life keeps happening. You do not suddenly become some other thing. You're going to attain your greatest desire in this life. You're going to finally be a published author and you're still you. You're either ready for that or you're not.
I do want to talk about more things from 2023. What was your favorite movie of the year?
Barbie was the best thing I saw all year. And I saw a lot of really good movies this year. I loved American Fiction. I thought Oppenheimer was a work of genius. I really loved.
Is American Fiction out?
American Fiction just came out. I saw it the other night. Jeffrey Wright is spectacular. I can never remember the name. The person who played Maxine on Living Single is in it, and she has not aged a day, and she's such a revelation, and I love seeing her in something again. It does great, great jokes on how racist publishing is and what we expect from Black people and how white people sort of force Black people to perform a certain kind of Black experience so that we can have feelings about it. And it's so funny and at the same time so human and has such wonderful moments of deep feeling. Every writer should see it, but it's also just a really good movie.
But Barbie is still doing it for you, huh?
Barbie's still doing it for me. It had great music. It had just spectacular art direction. I've never seen a film that looked like that. I love a commitment to a color palette. When it finally came out streaming, I watched it again because there is nothing like it. And Greta Gerwig is an uncommon visionary.
My favorite movie of the year, I can't stop thinking about. I've also rewatched it in my home 10 times.
Dungeons and Dragons.
That was surprisingly charming.
With Chris Pine.
Yeah.
It was so good and so smart, and it was just fun. It was witty. It took you places. It surprised you. It also didn't ask a lot of you. It's just the most perfect popcorn movie. And there were moments this year when I just desperately needed some escapism, and it was so good. And just, it felt like it was new. It was something new. It could be the start of something. I would watch 20 movies in this universe. I hope we have so many more. It wrapped me up in magic and story, and I needed that.
I think that's been a really important vibe for a lot of people this year, because we lived through and are still living through such a long pandemic and so many years of uncertainty, and so many terrible things have happened and are happening. I think that's partially the reason why T.J. Kingfisher is an author who keeps winning the Hugo for best novel, and they write really fun, cozy, easy to get into adventure fantasy stories. And that is what a lot of people need right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a little bit of fun. What's something you want to leave behind in 2023?
I never want to hear the word unprecedented again. I would like to leave that behind.
Can I just say, this also happens in like witchy spaces too. Like this is the first alignment of a super blood dyadic artisanal.
Yeah. Neptune's moon. Never gone into retrograde and just in the fifth house. It's always some... Everything's happened before. It's a clock and the parts move in the same direction every year. I also, if you want to talk about witchy stuff, I never want to hear the word intentions again. Just speak your intention. Speak your intentions over the purple candle.
Oh my God. And jars. Everything's in a jar. Why is everything in a jar?
I think the Pinterest girlies bought like a gross of ball jars each in 2016, and they all came with like twine and burlap and little white fairy lights. And now that trend is over, but they still have all these fucking jars.
So many jars!
The Pinterest girlies have become the Witch Talk girlies, and they have to repurpose the crap that they bought.
I get that we're doing stuff that like looks pretty on social media, but I'm like, I'm looking at accounts and I'm like, it's salt, cayenne, either basil, rosemary, or lavender, and then you take some incense and you put it in the jar. And I'm like, what is the purpose of this being in a jar? It is only slightly better than that, the candles with the tied wicks.
Yes, with the wicks tied together, and there's like a scroll wrapped around the candle, and it's got the rhyming spell.
Hate it. Stop it. Get that it looks pretty for social media, but you do one video.
It's in a lot of practical spell books. Like if you got one of those like spell a day books, it's stuff that takes 30 seconds to set up and no time at all to understand.
Okay. I'm sick of social media accounts that are couples or families.
Oh, definitely. The people who are just filming their kids enduring terrible pain or like real anguish. Please stop. Please let's leave that in 2023.
I'm genuinely, genuinely glad that there is legislation being put forward to if your kids are going to be used in social media, then they have to like be compensated and like their money has to be set aside. Like it's not your money. There's so many parents that are like, people love cute babies here. Now I will collect money and I will... make my kid the object of this media empire that they did not consent to be a part of.
In other places in the industry, like if you get a movie contract for a baby or a child, like that money is protected. Yes. Those kids there have been people who've been exploited by their families and end up penniless. So now we have protections and regulations for those kids, and the kids on social media have nothing.
People are getting millions upon millions of views. They're getting hundreds of thousands of dollars in compensation, in merchandise, in trips, and all of this stuff. And none of that is going to the kid. And the kid can't consent anyways. So I think the entire thing's a moot point.
Can't withdraw consent. They can't remove themselves from the situation. Like those kids have no rights. The best thing you can do for those children is not watch, not follow, scroll right past it. Report it if you have to. The least you can do is not watch.
Yeah. And I have to say, every single time I see one of these perfect couples make it an Instagram about how we're just like, this is our morning routine. I'm like, you got up, you put your phone in your microwave. And then you and your partner spent 12 minutes arguing about what color their boxers would be to match the t-shirt that you were wearing. And you waited until the light came in your kitchen window in such a way, and all so that you could show off your Nespresso or whatever the hell you're trying to sell. Like, I will say, one of the better parts about all of this is I do think that we are finally seeing the death knell of the influencer as like a profession.
I think that we're in the post prime of that for sure. And things like lobotomy core have really helped sound that death knell. You've heard about this?
Lobotomy core. Why are we coring everything?
Everything is core. Everything is core, just like everything used to be punk. So lobotomy core is primarily women who are like, get ready with me to be a stay-at-home girlfriend, or watch me take care of my three beautiful children. But the thing is like, it's extremely cozy, soothing content. And they sort of stare off into the distance while they like stir up a big bowl of pancake batter in their house. No, it's intended to be serious.
I saw one of those videos where it's like this woman in this like pretending like she's in a prairie dress, but she lives in just like a Dallas suburb with like her... her two children of the corn, and it's like, I homeschool my children and they play with soft felt toys.
That's it. The house is one color and it's spotless, and she looks like she's had part of her room removed.
Millennial gray houses need to die a death.
I hate millennial gray. Can that be left in 2023? Can we not have that anymore? I would be so
happy. But I do think that this whole era of the overly curated, staged, where somebody is just so clearly rehearsed their surprise face,
it's so fake,
so that they can go viral, so that they can sell the cutting board in the background or whatever the hell they've been sent. And it's like,
we went full circle on viral video, because the original viral video is like an actual surprise, an actual, you know, someone didn't know it was going to happen. It's those poor kids drinking mugs of beer in their apartment in New York, and they're filming a video for their mom and dad, and then the plane hits the tower. Like, that's where we started. And then we've gone all the way around the circle to people trying to make that happen. But you can't fake that kind of surprise. You can't fake spontaneity. Nobody's that good an actor, and most people are not that good a writer. So we've come around to the verisimilitude of reality, and it's easily detected, and it's very tiresome.
A lot of people could get away with it when we were primarily influencers via photo, because it was one overly curated photo and you had the bokeh in the background and yada yada. As we transition to video, I think people are like, oh, you were just full of it the entire time. This isn't really your life.
Also, people have become fucking detectives. Like, people don't scroll past your video anymore. They look carefully and be like, oh, the hot dogs exploding out of that can don't have a shadow, so obviously this is fake. Like, we've developed the CSI effect of being able to tell what we're looking at and how fake it must be. And
the professional influencer's job is to sell things. And now, the algorithm has figured out a way to not even need them to do that anymore. Like, just everything is an ad now. Everything is an ad. You cannot get away from it. And I think people are just so exhausted by being sold to. I think we're just kind of reaching the end of the one person marketing team. And I get it. I mean, paying one person what sounds like to them a lot of money, paying them $5,000 to do a video
instead of
$50,000 or $100,000 or $500,000. But I talked to a VP of one of the country's largest ad firms, I guess a year ago or so, a little over a year. I said, you know, would you rather spend money on one influencer doing one video, or would you rather invest that into traditional advertising? And she's like, oh, influencer, 100%. But like, even now, that has already changed. It's already changed. We are already getting away from it. I'm glad to see the death of the monetized influencer. Okay, I know we can't be shady about books. Can we be shady about movies?
Yes, I think that's safe.
What's the movie that you were just like, what was this? What was this? Why'd we do this?
I was really excited about The Holdovers, and I really thought I would enjoy it. And the pacing in it makes no sense. It takes 3 hours to say nothing. I feel like they were trying to find it in the edit and they never found it. The movie that it's set up to be never materializes. And it's the kind of thing that I usually like very much. I love a character-driven story about real people, you know, just living their real lives. And this is about a boys' school in New England and kids who have to stay over the Christmas holidays. And it just goes nowhere. It has like nothing to say.
What was it called?
The Holdovers, Paul Giamatti.
But he's so good.
He's really good. He's the best part of it, but he cannot make a script that does nothing do something. He's a great performer. He's a gifted performer, but there's nothing there.
Oh, man. It's been a year for some really good movies. I'm looking back at my list of movies, and I completely forgot how many great, like, really good movies came out this year. A Haunting in Venice was great. I bought the soundtrack and then listened to all of that. Even My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3 was surprisingly good. Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Yes. Red, White, and Royal Blue.
It was really good. Oh, I'm so sorry. This is going to make me the worst. I'm going to be the worst.
Let's hear it.
Asteroid City. I'm sorry.
You're just wrong. You're just wrong. It is the best Paul Thomas Anderson film and one of the best films I saw this year.
I'm sorry. I watched that and I was like, I know I am a smart person. I have media literacy. I am an artist. I have acted. Grew up in the theater. I'm a writer. I have all of the tools necessary to love this movie. I did not like that movie.
I think it's his best work, but it's okay. What? We can disagree. It's his best work.
You think that is his best movie?
Yes, without question.
He did this short film that was like 20 minutes long for Netflix this year as well, and it starred Benedict Cumberbatch. That was better for me than Asteroid City. Because Anderson figured out, oh, I only need to tell the story. I don't need all this other stuff.
He gets lost in his own aesthetic. I know. And he loves to have characters struggle to arrive at their point. He likes to let them meander in their dialogue. It's not my favorite thing, but I understand why he does it. I just thought it was gorgeous, first of all. I mean, Asteroid City has wonderful cinematography and has, I think, more on work out of Scarlett Johansson than maybe anybody's ever gotten from her.
If we were going by, oh, this movie is so pretty and that redeems it, then wouldn't like Aeon Flux have won the Oscar or something?
I have good things to say about Aeon Flux, but I also thought the Asteroid City script had some very meaningful things to say about grief and the way we run from ourselves and what it means to be human and why we're endlessly curious about stuff like space. And I was moved by it. It's okay. We don't have to agree. It's okay. You got anything else on your least favorite movies of the year?
Nothing that I like that strikes me as like, oh, I watched that and I was very surprised. But I just keep thinking about like how many very, very, very good movies. And I think we had so many good movies this year because so much of last year, like 2020, you know, the pandemic kind of pushed so much forward. Yes. So there was a lot of really good stuff that came out very, very quickly in the first like 5 months of this year. There was just a lot of good stuff, hit after hit after hit.
So many. Absolutely. Yes.
Words you never want to hear again after 2023.
Surge. I really hate the word surge. I'm very sick of it. And it usually refers to either the levels of COVID in a city or pricing, both real bad. I don't want to hear supply chain problem ever again. I'm real sick of that. And okay, so there are some things we have to talk about. Like, it's really important to talk about the inshittification of the various platforms that we rely on inflation. And also, I feel like we should coin the phrase for when a thing stays the same price or becomes more expensive, but becomes of lesser quality at the same time. I feel like we should call that inflation. Anyway, we have to talk about all those things. And also, I'm so sick of hearing those words because they just indicate my quality of life declining as I work more and harder every year. Do you have words you'd like to leave behind?
Oh, very much so. But I think mine, just because of how much time I spend online, are all like more like discourse related. Like, I'm really tired of hearing words like triggered when you're not triggered. Yeah. I'm really tired of hearing words like all that like discourse related mess that people are using.
Yeah, they're good words that like people have used incorrectly so often.
You're not being gaslit. Yeah. That's not what gaslighting is.
Gaslighting is now meaningless. That went from a very specific term to any time somebody lies to you or says something you don't want to hear. It has been obliterated.
There are so many words that like mean pretty important and very serious things that we have turned into internet discourse stuff. I think is some kind of psyop to delegitimize those words or something. I don't know, but like,
I'm pretty sick of the word discourse.
I just really just want to stick them up on the tippy top shelf, way up high, until the internet has earned them back.
You have to wait until you're old enough to appreciate them, and you're not allowed to use them. I feel like grooming is about to become one of those words.
Oh my god,
grooming is about to
happen. Age gap discourse needs to die in a fire. What was that? The actor Rachel Zegler, right? And the internet was making an absolute meal out of the horrible age gap between her and her boyfriend that she had just celebrated 2 years with. And they were like, oh my God, her boyfriend's a groomer. She's dating a groomer. And it was like, she was 18 when she met him and he was 23. And then like 2 years later, they started dating or something like that. And then they've been together for 2 years and like she's 20 and he's like 25, no. But they were characterizing it as like he's almost 30 and she's this baby. Like, one, this grooming discourse infantilizes people.
Adults, usually adult women, yes.
Full-grown adult people that are making adult decisions. Like, you are telling me that this woman has enough wherewithal to become the face of a multi-billion dollar franchise and to spend years of her life creating a career and running her own empire, which when you're operating at that level is what you're doing. You have people that work for you. You have staff. You have employees. You know, yada, 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 yada. You're telling me that this woman has all of that autonomy, but she couldn't decide who she wanted to date.
Also cannot choose a romantic partner.
Everything about like the weird age gap stuff and the like the whole anti-sex thing that we see a lot these days. Yeah. It's weird because usually these age gaps are like, well, 3 years apart. That, I mean, like, it's like if they didn't go to high school together,
they can't possibly then it's grooming. Be evenly matched. Yeah. Between the bizarre age gap discourse and the ultra conservative use of the word groomer to refer to anyone who's gay, I think that word's dead. I think we're leaving it behind. Yeah.
I hate it. I hate it so much.
I never want to hear it again.
Something exciting. Is there a scientific discovery, a historical revelation? Was there some fun news story for you that was just like a little perfect little gem?
I've had a couple of those this year. There's been a huge breakthrough in the treatment and nearly cure of sickle cell anemia, which disproportionately affects people of African descent. It's a very difficult disease to live with, and there was a huge advancement in it this year. Right now, it's still not accessible to everybody. It's still very, very expensive, and it's only been tried out on a few individuals, but it is just about proven in humans, and that's great news. Similarly, there was a huge breakthrough in the treatment of lupus, which is a particularly difficult to live with autoimmune disease, but they think that what they discovered can be applied to other autoimmune diseases, which would be a huge leap forward for people who have a lot of chronic suffering. I was really excited to see that. Also, I'm not sure why. I'm sure the reasoning behind it is very complex, but this was the first year in like 20 years when there was less Amazon deforestation than the year before it. And it's a decrease of like 50%. Yeah, I just read that this morning. And each one of these stories just lit me up and made me so happy for a few minutes. So great things. What were yours?
The one that I really came back to is actually a fairly recent one. And I was just very lucky that I got to interview the actual researcher who published the study. But there was a team of researchers out of Texas A&M that decided to study anger and whether anger has any kind of effect, positive or negative, on us. It was a team led by a woman researcher. And what I really loved about the research is she said, we wanted to study anger, the positive evolutionary science behind anger, because we're told not to feel it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of groups out there that are specifically told that anger has no function, that anger has no use.
Or that you're unacceptable in public if you appear to be angry.
Yeah, it's a thing that we should not be feeling. Right. And what their research found is actually anger is the most productive emotion. If you feel angry, you will get more stuff done. You're better at problem solving. You will accomplish your tasks better and more efficiently than feeling literally anything else, including neutrality. And really talking to her about just like the evolutionary science behind feelings and emotions, which I really enjoy that kind of work, just kind of where my own research mind is heading with my next nonfiction. But like, I just really kind of love that internal struggle that we're all contending with right now about like, maybe we should be examining some of this darker stuff that we've all been feeling these last few years. Maybe grief has a purpose. Maybe anger has a purpose. Maybe we are feeling these things for a reason, and maybe we shouldn't tell people to stop feeling them. Now, I really loved that. I will say most other research terrified me.
A lot of bad research came out this year too. I wanted to.
It was like everything about space this year. I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
We're a little busy right now. We're not taking any comments from space. Thank you so much.
Earlier this year, this ice cap is melting. We found this ancient tomb. It had a weird liquid in it. Like, don't. Put it back.
Put it back.
No, put the cork back in it. Like, yeah. Stop poking it. Oh, yeah. There's a whole extra ocean down below the earth. Don't. Right. I don't want to. Yeah. That's where Godzilla lives. I don't want to find him. No, thank you.
Leave her alone. She's had such a hard time.
It's fine. What's the best little gadget that has come into your life in 2023? Is it the same as mine?
It might be the same as yours. Is yours your mouse wiggler?
Mine is my mouse wiggler.
Okay, so here's the problem. If you don't work from home, you might not know. There are periods in a work from home job where you can safely be away from your computer when you have done your work and you no longer need to be there. But if you look consistently idle on many forms of software used to surveil the American worker and not as though you're busy, it could reflect poorly on how people perceive your performance. So the mouse wiggler is a device that sits with your mouse or on your touchpad to make it seem as though you are always active. And, you know, you're still in your house. You're not taken off to Aruba. You can still hear it if you get a message or somebody's trying to get a hold of you. But in the meantime, you stay in the green. It is a wonderful thing to own.
It is a magical, wonderful, mystical device. I do not know how I lived so many years without it. It is absolutely indicative of the privileged, 15% of the work. Isn't it 15% of the workforce is still work from home? Like, that's larger than I thought. Like, it's
gaining ground. A lot of people, I think everybody should have the option to work from home, but I feel very lucky.
There are so many jobs that are like, all we're doing is just being on our computer.
Exactly.
Like, why do you need me here to do that?
For what I do or for what you do, there is no reason why they need us in a physical location where they collect rent and electricity for us to sit in the same place. I can do this job from home.
Yeah, it's so great because there's a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, I'm sending an email and I really can't progress in my day until I've received the response to this email. So I'm going to go do a load of laundry.
Right.
But if I don't have the mouse jiggler, then my computer might go to sleep and then I won't hear the ding.
I won't hear.
And know that the email came back. So the mouse jiggler fixes all the problems. It's so great. Best $20 I spent the whole year.
Same. It's literally $20 and it is life changing.
So good.
I have not missed a single email. I have not been behind on a single deliverable. I stay interdependent with my team. My team, by the way, sent me on a group chat. They're like, this is the mouse jiggler you should get for this job. So everybody knows. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. Okay. I want to get into some listener questions.
Yeah.
I have some listener questions that are specifically for you.
Okay.
That were sent to my inbox and my DMs that were like, listen, I love you. You're great. But these questions are for Meg.
I see how it is. All right. They're just using you to get to me.
What is the most stereotypical writer thing you do?
Oh, boy. I guess all writers like to drink. I very much like to drink. I also love to eavesdrop on other people's conversations and turn it into dialogue. Oh, not usually word for word, but like the vibe, I'm always eavesdropping for the vibe. I collect pens. That's a very writer thing that I do.
Oh, that's so funny. I don't do any of those. I mean, when I'm writing poetry, I listen to people's conversations, but I don't have a pen addiction. Now, I will say the clicky clacky keyboard is probably mine. I do love a clicky clacky keyboard.
Very much a writer thing, yes.
I'm figuring if I'm going to listen to it for hours on end, I would like it to be enjoyable and tactile and have a pleasant sound.
It does have a wonderful sound. People love
the. I don't know why, but the clicky clacky has more words in it.
Okay.
And I write more with the clicky clacky than if I'm just at my laptop. Do you have a favorite ridiculous author story other than all the ones that we've already talked about from this year?
One through this year. One of my very favorite author stories is a short and sweet one. And when Dorothy Parker went on her honeymoon, she was working as a newspaper writer and a columnist, and her editor tried to reach her on her honeymoon and sent her a telegram. And she's like at Waikiki Beach with her brand new husband. She is not to be disturbed. So she sent him a telegraph in return to his desk in New York City. And she said, please do not attempt to contact me, too fucking busy, and vice versa.
I do love modern technology. I really do. But there are days when I wouldn't mind rewinding everything like 60 years and just telegraph, landline.
It's very difficult to disappear now.
I grew up being able to just like leave my house and nobody knew where I was. You just had to trust that I was going to show up somewhere.
It is crazy now to think we used to live that way, but we really did.
And it was not that long ago. It wasn't like, oh, this was, you know, so many decades ago. This was like, I was a homeowner and you could still live like this. Yeah. So sad. I'm old. Best advice on fountain pen maintenance. Is it, I have an additional question, is it to stab the pen into the villain's neck.
They do make an excellent improvised weapon, as you will find in my novel, Number One Fan. Thanks for the layup there. But I think the best advice that I have is store it at an angle instead of point down, and always keep alcohol on hand. Clean your nibs, because a clogged up nib is nobody's friend.
Because you will need tequila while cleaning it. Like, will you have to cuss a lot? Is it very difficult?
Not that kind of alcohol. The less fun kind of alcohol.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yes. There's an Instagram account and a Twitch account called The Ink Witches, and they do fountain pen demonstrations and repairs and reviews, and they both are way more obsessed with fountain pens than I could ever be. It's run by the author, Mallory O'Meara, and the art director, Lauren Penapinto, and they put together such a good show. So if you want to know more about fountain pens, that would be the first people I would tell you to follow.
Do you have a favorite author beef?
Yes.
War of the authors.
I mean, okay, so these are legendary. People have been doing it since there were authors. You know, they fight each other either overtly or covertly. And one of my favorites is overt. And there's a great story from the time that Ernest Hemingway slept with Wallace Stegner's sister. And it was like the 20s. So Wallace Stegner was like, you have to marry her. And Hemingway's like, no. So Hemingway like wrote her a letter and was like, hey, thanks, I had a great time, but I hope you don't think anything is going to be serious about it. And Stegner challenged him to a fight, and Hemingway was like a World War I veteran who hunted lions in his spare time, and Stegner was like a loaf of white bread with a college degree. He let Stegner hit him one time first, and well, Stegner's like a poet, so he punched Hemingway in the jaw. He got one free shot. He broke his hand, and then Hemingway beat the crap out of him.
Are you saying poets are fragile?
You said,
what are you trying to say about poets, Meg?
So he beat the crap out of him. And like 2 weeks later, they both wrote letters to the sister. And Hemingway was like, I'm really sorry I beat up your brother. It couldn't be avoided. Live with it. And Stegner wrote to his sister and said, dear sister, please forgive my penmanship. I fell down some stairs.
What is the favorite character you've ever written? And what is their name?
My favorite character is Flora from the Book of Flora. She's introduced in the Book of Veda.
Cheater.
She's the coolest. Come on. Why?
I was going to try to trick you into telling me the name of the unnamed midwife.
Oh, boy. Yeah. No, better men than you have tried.
Is that going to be you auctioning that information off when you're 70 and you invite somebody over for vodka and peanut butter sandwiches and you're like, okay. Here's what the name is.
I'm going to have to be talked into not taking that to the grave with me. So maybe. Do you have a favorite character of yours? Do you want to talk about it? Or is it in something unpublished and you can't talk about it yet?
Well, I mean, I don't have any fiction published yet.
Okay.
Isn't that strange? As much fiction as I've...
That's right. You have so much fiction. I've read so much of your fiction. Okay.
But yes, I do have a favorite. And if you read my next few books, you'll know. You'll know. They all fly.
Yes.
There you go. There's the... Everyone flies. All of my favorites fly and have so much trauma and a lot of body horror and grief, and everybody's very gay. So there's that. There's my teaser for that. Okay, this is a question I think for both of us. Thoughts on the current obsession with spicy romanticy and how it's affecting other genres?
I have a lot of feelings about this.
Me too.
It's really important as authors that we don't talk down to romance authors and never look down on romance, because it is the single most popular and most profitable.
By far. No, 100%. And that's the thing. And I've done a ton of videos about this. I have no beef with romance authors at all. Make your money.
Yeah, they make their money and they make people happy. And like,
they make people happy. There's so many. Romance is a huge umbrella too. And it's becoming so diverse, sort of like how science fiction is becoming so diverse. Science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, it's great news.
So many things. And so much representation is now happening in the romance world. It's so great. And it makes people happy. And it's so good. Here's the problem. Publishers know how much money. Mm-hmm. Romance makes, and are also seeing how certain genres are either struggling to sell or struggling to avoid book bans.
Right.
So what they're trying very hard to do is either pretend like everything is actually romance, or twist the arms of all of their authors and make them turn their books into a romance.
Yeah. that's never in the best interest of the art. Like, trying to make your book something that it wasn't to begin with is not going to make it better. And, you know, we've seen this with previous trends, like with a book that is really about disease, and agents are like, couldn't it be like zombies? Could the disease be zombieism, you know? Or like this book is about ghosts, and the agent's like, are they really like vampires though? Like, how different are vampires?
It feels more like a vampire story. Exactly. Yeah.
So we see this every couple of years with whatever literary trend is hot. So I would say to authors, don't let anybody try to change your book from what it was meant to be to something that's just trendy right now, because trends can just drop at any time. They just die underneath. You cannot predict where the book buying industry is going to be in 2 years. You just can't. With all that being said, I'm glad that Spicy Romanticy is having a moment and has found such a huge audience and is doing so well on TikTok and everywhere else. And I for one, like to see more sex in books and more weird sex. And I'm so glad people are getting after it and that the audience is so enthusiastically for it in a time when books are being banned and challenged much more often mm-hmm. than having any sexual content. So if you have a fairy who likes to fuck centaurs and people want to hear about it, I hope you sell a million books. I think that's great for everybody involved.
And that's the thing, is that there's room for everybody.
There really is.
At the publishing table, there is room for everyone. The problem is not with people writing what they want to write. The problem is not with readers reading what they want to read. The problem is genuinely with publishers yeah. who have the money and the clout to yeah. stand up to, and we are starting to see some of this, to stand up to book bans, to stand mm-hmm. up to censorship, to put a little bit of money and time in figuring out the right way to market things.
Right. Not trying to make it what's hot 6 months ago, but try to make the right marketing for what it really is.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the problem was with the power brokers, the people who hand out the contracts and try to buy up a slate of books, meaning that there are certain books that are left on the table, or, you know, twisting the arms of authors to turn their book into something that it wasn't. That's where the problem is, because trends come and go, and there's a lot of folks out there who kind of get left in the wake. The other thing, that just to kind of add to this, I've talked to this with a few other authors this year, maybe you as well, I can't remember, the tropification of books in the way that we talk about them. And I'm not talking about readers, talking about reader spaces. I'm specifically talking about like authors getting on social media and feeling pressured to talk about their book as a series of tropes. Because if I get on and it's, oh, it's an enemies to lovers, there's only one bed, he fell first.
It tells you nothing about what's actually in the book.
It tells you nothing about the plot of that book.
Yeah.
And it sounds like every other book on that shelf. And again, I'm not talking about readers and reader spaces. Readers and reader spaces, that's your job.
Yeah.
To make lists of, oh, if you like He Fell First, here's 27 other books that include that plot. We would do that with something else. Oh, do you like time traveling robots? Here's 27 other books with a time traveling robot. That's not a beef. What I'm having a problem with is authors that are so enamored with the idea of the tropification of books, figuring out what the next big trope is that's going to sell, and then writing to tropes. And then your plot has all of the depth of a mud puddle in Texas in August. Because the only thing that your book has is tropes, and there's no plot, like there's nothing in it.
No character, no plot, no events, just vibes, just tropes. Yeah.
Just vibes and tropes. Like, who is your character? Like, you and I have talked. What are some basic novel writing 101 you absolutely, as an author worth your salt, have to know? Who is your character? What do they want? What is standing in their way?
That's
and
it.
There are just too many books coming out that are being rushed into production to meet a trend. I'm telling you right now, these authors could not answer those questions.
Awful. And you'll never catch the trend. Never. So we have a ton of questions for Don from his many avid fans, listeners,
many,
all 12. So many. So you ready to kick some of those off?
Yes, please.
All right. Charlotte would like to know, are you planning to write any more witchy books? Because she enjoyed The Dabbler's Guide so very much.
Well, it's really sweet. It's really kind. A few people asked that, and I do have plans for another nonfiction, and I am dying to tell you about them, but I don't know that it's as explicitly witchy as you want it to be, but it is still going to carry through a lot of the themes that I discussed in The Dabbler's Guide, just maybe in a slightly different format. But it is still everything that people know and love about my nonfiction stuff. It's that investigative, interrogative, navel-gazing thing where I take difficult subjects and laugh at them.
That sounds great to me.
Are you writing a witchy book, Maggie Lison?
I have one in mind that I've been thinking about for a couple of years. I would like very much to write about witchcraft, so stay tuned. It's not written yet. It's in like the, it's not even on outline. It's idea stage, but I do believe it will happen.
I want to read the book that you will write.
There we
I'm
go.
So excited. There Can I just go. Say, Thorn Mooney has been talking about her new book, Witches Among Us, and mm-hmm. I've just seen some of this, and I think it's going to be in my inbox later today.
I'm so excited. It's so good to be with writers and get to see stuff.
Before. It is. The best and worst part about being a writer is that you end up making a lot of writer friends. And so all of your favorite books of the year are books that nobody else gets to read for like two more years. You don't get to talk to anybody about.
I went to a reading in New York City a couple of weeks ago, and I got to hear the first chapter of Carmen Maria Machado's next book. And I was like, gasping out loud, yelling, making a spectacle of myself, and I cannot wait for the rest of it. But I realize I've heard more of it than almost anybody else. It's just me and the people in that room.
I did get to read one of yours this year.
You did. It's true.
I did. I'm very excited for people to read it. I'm very, 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 very excited for it.
I'm dying. I'm dying for it to come out. I'm dying.
It makes the fifth grader who grew up reading and loving Animorphs very happy. It's so good. It's so good.
Yep, I wrote one for the weird little freaks, that's for sure. So this is a digression from your wonderful readers' questions, but I just thought of it. Did you have a favorite witchy book that you read this year? Because I know you read all the Thorne's book. Is there anything new that you just loved?
That is hard for me because these days, a lot of the stuff that I read as spiritual inspiration comes from outside of the witchy section. It isn't that I wasn't sent some really good and great things. I'm sure if Thorne sends me her book,
you will
her
love it.
Book.
Yes.
Will be the greatest That'll witchy book on. That I read this year. Yeah. Honestly, there were some poetry books that I think scratched that itch for me. Just in the weird way that I understand spirituality, I glean a lot of that from poetry.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I read Morgan Parker's Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night this year or last year. And the thing is, if you read that, is it a spiritual book? No, but like it's...
Yeah, but it also is.
It is. It is. Andrea Gibson, again, their book was, oh my God, just cathartic queer rage. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That just really spoke to me. The Boy and the Heron was a
the new Miyazaki.
Yeah, a Miyazaki movie about the power of grief and the imagination and the way that it can heal those things. Let's see. As far as like explicitly witchy books, there was a really cool book from Madame Pamita, I want to say is her name, about Baba Yaga that I thought was kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really fun. That was good. That was fun. I think I got that this year. I don't put a lot of those on social media just because I don't know if you feel the same way. Like once you've written in a genre, like published in a genre, it's hard to...
People attach weight to what you say in a very different way. If you're talking about like your category, so you got to be careful. Yeah.
They do. And I don't know. Some of these worlds, y'all just don't understand. Once you get kind of behind the ropes, some of these worlds are really small. And what you say, other authors get mad that you either didn't say them or that you picked the wrong author or something. So
you described it in a way that makes the author unhappy, even though you meant it as a compliment. Yeah. Like, it gets very complicated.
It's good that we have interesting new things coming out in the publishing landscape. I did get to read a really cool article about how Barbie is the new Inanna.
That was one of the best things I wrote all year, so I'm very happy with it.
And I reread Fairy Tale by Sydney Pike.
Oh, that, yes.
That was good.
All right, let's have another one from a reader. Paige is curious about how different the final product typically is from the original idea and what it's like to let go of what you thought you were creating.
Oh, I'm sure we both have a million stories. You have more than me at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The actual answer is that yes, the what you end up reading is usually quite different from the first idea. So with Dabbler's Guide specifically, there's a lot of stuff that was in the original outline that did not make it into the book. That just because like once you're in it and writing it, chapters suddenly smash together and chapters rip apart. And then even from the first few drafts, there were entire chapters that got deleted and other chapters that got written or extended.
Yeah.
I've talked about this earlier this year. I think I did a little giveaway around Halloween. There was a chapter on the 1,000-year history of the evolution of the term black magic. I don't know. At the end of the day, I was just like, I don't know that I'm the right person to write this.
Yep.
It's not that the research wasn't there. Yep. It's just it's 1,000 years in one chapter.
Which is a lot to ask. That's a whole book.
That's a whole book. Yeah. So I nixed it all except for one paragraph that went to a different chapter.
There you go.
As far as like fiction goes, well, as far as poetry goes, poems are basically always drafts.
Yes, they are.
Poems are always drafts until it's printed on the page. It is a draft.
And even then, people will perform their printed poems and they'll edit as they speak.
They'll change it. It's like a song. Like Kelly Clarkson updates her lyrics depending on how divorced she is at the time. Like I can...
True.
But so, you know, a lot of the poems that I perform, you know, like the more performy stuff is, you know, I wrote when I was very young. So some of it needs to be updated. I think fiction has your beats are there. Mm-hmm. Where you start and where you end are probably the same. And it's all how you get there that changes, because it's like, oh, well, this doesn't make sense that they got there this way. And that doesn't make sense that they got there that way. And I just did a big edit for What We're Out on Sub With right now. I mean, a big edit and not an edit. Like there's stuff that was like I knew and I trusted the reader to know, but you know, you had to change it because it's like, well, maybe I'm trusting the reader a little bit too much. What about you? Any major thing? Because I've already talked about mine earlier this year. I even like dropped the chapter for Patreon supporters so people can go read the unpublished chapter and probably realize why it didn't work.
I got cut. Yeah. I will say that the end product is always wildly different than where it starts out when I write fiction. Like, if you're not an author, the best metaphor that I have found is it's a book is essentially a recipe, and you told somebody you're bringing pumpkin pie to the party. So you have to show up with something that passes the pumpkin pie test, right? But you make a lot of adjustments while you're making it based on what works for you and what you need the end product to do. So you originally started off, you're like, I'm going to make pumpkin pie with a pecan praline topping. And then you get a text from the hostess and she's like, someone has a nut allergy. So you nix the nuts and you plan to make homemade pie crust, but you don't have enough butter and you don't have enough time. And you realize you have a pie crust in your freezer and it'll work and you use that. And then your pumpkin's expired and you go to the store and they don't have any canned pumpkin. And then you're roasting a whole pumpkin because it's the only way you could make it by the deadline. It's all those little adjustments that you make on the fly based on where you're at and where you need your audience to be at. And all of those changes mean that you end up with a very different pie than you first envisioned. Really good pie, and everybody loves it, and they fight over the last piece, and you're proud of it when you bring it to the party. It looks great, but it is not what you thought, because the pie in your mind is never the pie in reality. Books are just like that.
See, I used a very, very similar description to talk to somebody about people have been doing cameos and asking me for writing advice. And I used a similar description for a recipe, but it was, have you ever had a family recipe that like lives in your body?
Oh yeah. And then nothing is measured. And
if you asked me to go to the kitchen and make pumpkin pie, yes, I could make pumpkin pie. I could make the pie from scratch. People taste my pumpkin pie and know it's my pumpkin pie.
They know.
Is it always the same every single time? No, sometimes that crust just needs a little bit more water. Sometimes it's just, you know, you just kind of feel it. When there's family recipes that live in your body, they're not always the same thing every single time. But suddenly somebody says, how do you make your pumpkin pie? And then you have to write it down.
Yeah.
And then you have to commit to, okay, well, this is, wait, do I not? Oh, I thought I used that. No, I guess I don't do that.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I guess I do this.
Right.
Well, then there's this.
I sometimes use brown sugar, but only if I'm not out of brown sugar. And like, if I actually had a little more white sugar than I had brown sugar, I would make up the difference. And it's anything you get.
Because when you're thinking of the story, it all kind of gets to be hazy and blend together. And the parts that you're not sure on, you can just kind of gloss over in your mind. But when you're sitting there at the keyboard and you have to tell the reader how this happens, suddenly it's like, oh, I don't know.
It was a thing that I did in the moment. I felt it in my body and I cannot replicate
that. She just does. Okay?
It's not science. It's art. It's much more art than science.
Yes. She just does. Leave me alone about it.
It's a complicated question. It gets a complicated answer.
Yeah. Is there anything missing from any of your books that you would add back in?
Oh, man.
Or what's something that's missing from your books that fans of your books would love to know?
For the most part, when I cut something, the reason is that it needed to be cut. And I'm not always the one coming up with that cut. Sometimes it's my agent. Sometimes it's my editor. And I usually hate the idea because I am a maximalist and I want to say everything I can in a book. And when I look back at the work They were right.
Yeah, I hate it. I hate how other professionals who are good at their jobs are good at their jobs.
Editors, it turns out, are good at their jobs.
Turns out. Who knew?
I'm not a person who engages much in regret. And when I look back at my books, I am almost never sorry that I left something out.
I will say the one thing about your work, the one story in your canon that I always want more of is Layla.
People ask me all the time, what happened next with Layla? Where'd she go? What'd she do? I might return to her someday. I'm not opposed to the idea, but I ended that story where I felt like it needed to end.
I'd love for her to be an adult. I'd love to see how she uses what she has and does something more. I don't know. Maybe you kill her and put her in a ditch somewhere. I don't know. I don't know. She's yours. You do whatever you want with her. But it was just so, it's a short book.
It's a YA, young adult book, so it's shorter than most.
It's short. And I'm just like, oh my God, you have this way of writing that just takes your finger and just hooks it underneath your rib cage and just drags a reader along. And then suddenly it's over. And I'm just like, fuck happened? Where did the last 48 hours go? What? I need more. You have one of the most addictive writing styles I've ever read, and I hate you for it.
That is incredibly kind of you. Thank you very much. And I hope it keeps up and that people buy my books until I die and then stop. All right. So your readers, just as addicted, always wanting to know more. This one's very much about your life.
Oh.
The person who wrote in, it might be Harjit. It might be Harriet. It might be an interesting spelling of Harriet. I apologize. I'm not sure. H-A-R-J-O-T. This person wants to know, what is your day-to-day like when you have a horse farm, have a day job, are writing a book, running a podcast, and managing your social media, which is not small, all the time? How do you get any time for yourself?
I don't. This is my time for myself.
This is it. You're looking at it.
I'm in therapy.
That's good. I'm very glad you are.
I sleep very little. I always assume people are mad at me. I'm always on some kind of deadline or another. I'm working 24/7 doing something. Even if it looks like I'm not working, that's probably because I'm working or taking notes or emailing somebody about an edit or emailing a future guest for the show. Or when you're in the creative field, all of it's work. It's all work.
All of it's work. My wish for you in 2024 is that you take a vacation where you do not make any content you do not want to make. If you want to take thirst traps on a beach, that's for you. But I hope you get to truly unplug.
I would like to see the ocean in 2024. I've never been to the ocean. I really want that for me in 2024.
As a person who spent most of their life in California and now lives in New York, I cannot understand that. That is unthinkable to me.
I will say, you can help me out here. You can tell me where to go. We want to go on an ocean vacation. But now we're terrified because all the places where you can go for pretty cheap are evil and anti-gay. But I hear all the beaches in California are very cold. Like, I hear the water in California is very cold.
The water is cold in the Pacific, yes.
I want to be able to get in the water, so I don't know where to go anymore, because you can't go to Florida, because that's evil.
She can't go to Florida. The best recommendation I would give you is the Caribbean. The water in the Caribbean is always warm. It's my favorite place in the world to swim, and there's always, like, package deals. It's not a lot more expensive. As long as you have a passport, that would be where I would send you.
Okay. Thank you.
Wonderful warm sea. The best pictures I've ever taken in my life at a pink bikini on a Caribbean beach.
Baby.
And I want that.
I've seen it. Step on my neck.
I shall.
I do think it's just talking about schedules of creative people, because what I don't think a lot of people realize is how many authors have day jobs.
Almost all of us. Almost all of us have day jobs.
And I was shocked to know this, like, once I got behind the velvet rope of publishing, to find out that, like, most of the names on the, like, if you're a debut and you end up on a list somewhere, you probably have a day job. That person probably has a day job. Like, Shirin J. Zhao is a great example.
Yes, it's a day job. Runaway bestseller.
Runaway bestseller got $14,000 for an advance. At least, I think that's the math that I did based on the tweets that they posted. Yeah.
And they got it up into pieces. Like, you don't even get all your money.
Nope, you don't.
They until it's just like an extra paycheck.
Even if your book is a runaway bestseller, you are not seeing that money for 2 to 3 years.
It'll take a long time to pay you back. There's also something called bucket accounting, where you might be under contract for other books, and those books have to be paid back before you get any of the money from the first one. So you might have made $1 million for other people and get none of it yourself. Yep. You remember that documentary about TLC and how they were broke while they had the number one single in the world? That is most best-selling authors.
Even in Sink talks about it, how for a very long time, that massive runaway best-selling boy band was hand to mouth. They looked rich, but for most of their time together, they were not.
I know a handful of authors who do not have day jobs, and the reason that they don't is they enjoy the support of a spouse or a partner or their parents who have more money than God.
Yeah.
That is the only time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The people that I know that are able to be an author full time, one of two things happened. Either they were supported by somebody or they worked a day job and then put enough books out in the world that those books started earning enough royalties that they could legitimately consider that a living, or they won the lottery.
Yeah.
They got that seven-figure advance, multi-book deal, yada, yada, yada.
Which is very rare.
That's very rare. It's not going to happen to you. It's just, it's not.
The number of books that we're talking about here to generate enough ongoing income that you can live off it is typically 10 or more books, all of which earn out and earn money. And the chances of that are slightly less than winning the lottery.
Yeah. Was it 25% of authors earn out? I think something like that.
I feel like it's such a flex when I post that my books earn out. Every single one of my books has earned out except my last so far. And like only authors know what a flex that is. Yeah. Most people are not aware. Most books only earn back enough money that the publisher's not out on your advance.
Yeah.
Most of them never get there. The vast majority never get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fun little secret from me to you, the reader. We all work.
Yeah, we all work.
We all dream of not.
So
maybe I should write a romanticy.
It'd be about that, yeah.
Maybe I should be writing romance. What was that? The dinosaur porn? When there were a thing years ago where some people made a pretty tidy living writing.
Raptor porn.
Yeah. Maybe I should be doing that.
On the subject of trying to live your life and always working, as a content creator, do you find it difficult to guard your private life?
Yes. My husband has never been on my social media. My family, my personal friends don't usually appear on my social media with very rare exceptions. People like yourself who already are public people. Other people who you meet that are already doing this.
Already in the business.
The business, yada, yada, yada. But I've also just this year, my following 12 months ago was a fraction of what it is now. This year has been a runaway weird train.
Here's
the stuff that has happened to me this year is just bonkers bizarre in lots of good ways, but in some terrifying ways too, because I have had more eyeballs on me this year than I've ever had in my entire life. Many times over, like wasn't just once. It happened many, many, many times. And it was weird because you see people zooming in on your photos and zooming in on your videos and pausing things and re-editing you and like writing articles about you. And it's just, I don't know. It's just, it's not like, am I like terribly famous? No, but it's weird to be perceived like that. And like people talk about you in your comments as though you're not there.
Yeah.
As though you're not the one reading all of these, as though I'm not on my couch watching Selling Sunset, reading all these comments.
I feel like every platform has a tipping point. And once you reach that tipping point of the number of followers, you cannot behave like a normal person anymore. You have to start behaving like a public figure. Yeah. I feel like at Twitter, that happened at about 10,000. On Instagram, I would say it happens at about 100,000.
For me, that happens significantly less.
Sooner? Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say like 20 to 50. 20 to 50,000.
And then 100,000 on TikTok?
Yeah, 100,000 on TikTok, just because TikTok's numbers for a while. This year, it's not as much, but for a while, they were very overinflated.
Also, people don't linger on your content. Like, people are just scrolling through. They're not finding you from your page. Yeah. So, like, Instagram people will go to your grid and check you out. TikTok people find you by accident.
Instagram, the number is lower. Like, it used to be around 10,000, and then the algorithm changed a little bit. Now, I would say it's probably 20 to 50,000 when you kind of have to start thinking, okay, how much of me can I be? Or at least that's about the number when I started those questions. Like I went back through and I was like, I've posted photos of my nieces before. Maybe I go take those down. I've posted...
Threshold and risk categories will be very different for people of color than they'll be for either me or Don. And they're typically pretty different for women than they are for men. They're different for queer people than they are for straight people. Like discomfort will set in at asymmetrical times.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird thing whenever you have to start going, oh... You know, this was the first year where I was like, suddenly it's just a much different audience than I've ever had, a much bigger audience. Yeah. And it's like, oh, you're abusing that cat. Oh, you're abusing. And it's like, you can't just post cute photos of your dog or your cat anymore. Cause like somebody's going to accuse you of animal abuse. And I'm just like, I mean, even though their opinion does nothing, it just sucks to read.
Especially if you have to read it in huge.
Yeah. Like hearing it once is one thing. Hearing it 70,000 times.
even if it's completely untrue, it's very jarring. Yes.
So, yeah, you know, like you talked about, there are thresholds whenever you start, like, okay, there are some considerations that I need to make. But also, I mean, you know, there's the benefits of it because Jinx Monsoon came to my house last week, you know? I mean, like,
which was cool.
Ellen DeGeneres, I'm the only non-Ellen DeGeneres content on the Ellen DeGeneres feed, which I feel like would have been a much bigger flex once upon a time. But like, still,
still, it's not nothing. It's still huge exposure.
It's crazy. Like, I don't know, just lots of, like, just the people that, like, know who I am now and are in conversation with me and talk about me in other rooms. Jerry Saltz asked Sharon Stone a question that he sourced from me.
Hey, that's awesome.
He was like, hey, I'm interviewing Sharon Stone. You ask really good questions. I'd love to pass one along.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
Now, I mean, Sharon Stone, if you're listening, I do ask good questions.
I'm sure it's your show. Yeah, you ask, I do good, ask questions. Good questions.
What about for you? We did talk kind of at the top about the shift from authors getting to be a black and white photo in the back of the book to having to become influencers. How has this shift changed you? How much of yourself do you feel like you get to be?
I really like to be accessible. I really love when my readers write to me or ask me questions about my books. I have come to treasure those interactions. They're a wonderful part of my life. And at the same time, I have to be pretty careful. I have met some scary people. I've had a couple of stalkers, although not since I left California, so that's nice. So it's made me more careful about posting my exact location. Mm-hmm. Posting the location that I'll be in before I've left it. I typically latergram some stuff because I don't need anybody following me to where I physically am. And it's made me more careful about conventions where there are big crowds and a lot of things can happen.
I used to geotag a lot of stuff and I don't do that anymore.
I don't do that anymore. That's over. That's canceled. But I really want to stay as accessible as I can be. And it's a constant strain to figure out, like, what is the safe amount of myself to perform and be open to people telling me what they think of me. And I, for the record, love when someone says, I read your book, it changed my life, or I gave it to my mom. Like, all those things are so welcome. But every three of those is one deeply personal comment on what I look like or what someone would like to do to me. And there doesn't seem to be any way to filter that out. And if I'm accessible to one, I end up accessible to the other. So I have been figuring that out. I don't have as large an audience on social media as you do. So I have had more time and space to figure it out, which has been great. I'm not saying online life is not real life, but I've tried to stay concerned with my physical safety more than I am about, because I'm really good at not reading the comments and breezing past the dumb shit people say. You're the 45th person today tell me I'm fat. Take a number.
This guy sounds gay. Really?
Shocking. Are you shocked?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Don, I think.
Revolutionary. Revolutionary work you're doing here, bud. You are solving the crime of the century, the mystery of the ages. Sounds like he kisses boys. There is a weird threshold at which, and I feel bad about this because this is the part where you start building walls between yourself and you stop being as accessible as you maybe would like to be. But there is a threshold where I don't answer DMs anymore.
Oh God, no, DMs are so far out the window.
Not even just like, I don't like what you, I like what your feet might smell like if they were, like, it's not like that. Even just people who are just like, I really love your video, it's really nice, da, 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 da. I don't answer those a lot of times because the way that social media works right now, like places like Instagram and stuff, if I answer it, that opens the door to you forever. It is an open door. I can't close the door anymore. And people suddenly get really parasocial with you. And it might not be today, it might not be tomorrow. But if I do not know you, or we are not in like mutual conversation, but if you're just like a fan, you're going to cross the line. You will ask an overly personal question because you think you can. You'll share something overly personal that I don't want to receive that. So I just don't answer DMs anymore. And that happened around that 20 to 50,000 mark. But it's just like, I'd love to get to the level where I could have a team or one person, but that's many zeros at the end of your social media away. That's 50 million followers. Then you're probably making enough money. You have a social media manager. Very different.
Very different. Along the same lines, when you're thinking about the people who watch your content or read your books, Angie asked the question, is imagining your audience a necessary part of your writing process? Do you, like, are you always thinking about the way people will see what you're creating?
I think that this is a really good question in a roundabout way to talk about writers needing to figure out who their audience is. Because the question a lot of times comes up, who is the reader? Who is your viewer? Who is your listener? Who is your whatever? And a lot of times the author says, well, me. But that is an insufficient answer.
Totally, yeah.
I talked to you earlier this year and I said, oh, well, my fiction is for young queer kids who grew up on superhero fiction and grew up realizing nobody's coming to save them. And it's like, that's my reader. It's not the smallest audience. It's not the broadest audience, but that is who I know is going to pick up my stuff. I get the urge to say it's me, but you also have to know who you're writing for, mostly because when you are writing, you have to make sure it makes sense to them. But I do want to make sure that I'm writing something that I would want to read, that I think other people would want to read, that says something different than other things in the landscape, but isn't so wildly different that somebody couldn't put it on a shelf somewhere. I think that you have to imagine who that person is. Where are they reading your book? Why are they picking up your book? And I think that that's important for you to know, like, if you have the kind of authorial voice that lends itself to wit and quips, don't run away from that. If you're going to write a thriller, there's thrillers that are quippy thrillers. I'd love a quippy thriller. Find that. Do that.
Totally.
If you're cinematic, great. But you have to keep your audience, your reader in mind. You have to know who that person is. What about you?
I really love the idea of writing for myself. And I do. Like, every book I have written is a book that I wished existed on the shelf. I went looking for that book and I didn't have it, so I had to write it. That is 100% true. And at the same time, I try to picture someone I actually know, not a fictional person, not a bad faith reader, not the worst fucking person on Reddit, but someone who I'm actually acquainted with, who I can imagine how they think and what they've already enjoyed. And I think, I'm writing this for Shannon, or I'm writing this one for Melissa, or I'm writing this one for Jackie. Like, there is a real person in my mind. And I think, what books do they love? How can I write a thing that they would love? That works much better for me than assuming a hostile audience or an unknowable audience.
To be specific about something that I have published, like Dabbler's Guide. Yes, I wanted to write the book that I wish that I'd had access to 20 years ago. But also, I wanted to make sure that I was writing for that reader that is so desperate to hand the book to somebody. Not only to say, yes, these are the conversations I've been having, these are the points that I have been searching for answers for, yada, 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 but also for somebody to say, okay, here's your first book, but I want you to read this first, or I want you to read this after. To be successful in that regard, I needed to know my audience well enough that I was also willing to part with certain audiences.
There are people who are not going to like it. And the sooner you accept that, the faster you move.
But not like in an antagonistic way. I just had to be okay with like, this person is my audience, this person is not my audience. Because the flip side to the I'm writing a book for myself is when an agent or an editor or someone says, well, who is the reader for your book? The other urge is to say everyone.
Yeah, you can't say everyone. You can't say it's the next big thing. It's going to everybody who loves the people who love Twilight and The Joy of Sex and The History of Baseball, they're all going to love this book. That's never true. When an agent or an editor asks me who's going to like this book, I think of that friend. I think of the person I had in mind in the first place. And I say, you know, college-educated women who have enjoyed books like The Secret History or My Dark Vanessa. And, you know, we try to think of your comps and weave a narrative of a person who has a money to spend on books.
Yeah. But I think that, I think that people need to get a little bit stronger in releasing an audience. People are too hooked on the idea that, oh, I'm so for everybody. Another listener question that we got for both of us from Blue Haired Babe. If you could correct one error in a book or movie that drives you nuts, what would it be? I would like to go first. I would like to correct absolutely every single thing about every X-Men movie ever made. They did finally correct Scarlet Witch's powers somewhat.
Somewhat. It's really hard to write somebody who can manipulate reality.
She manipulates
in their
probability. That's the whole problem. They started off as a low rent Jean Grey. And then they're like, well, we're just going to jump into chaos magic. And they skipped the whole part
where what she does is
manipulates probability, not like Domino.
Okay, but the outcomes of probability are a thing that we like to call reality.
Well, first X-Men. Problem is, Jean Grey is my favorite comic book character, and nobody has ever written her correctly because They're just like, woman, too much power, goes hysterical, eats son, kills everyone. And it's like, that is not Jean Grey. She becomes a god and chooses to give it up, but can't. Yes. It's all this like, well, women with too much power, am I right? They did the same thing with Scarlet Witch in the last Doctor Strange movie. Oh, too much power, must kill everybody. Yes. Scarlet Witch does go insane.
Everybody has
She does the whole no more mutants thing. But that's the thing, is if you're going to do that, you have to do the House of M storyline. Anyways, so I just
want control of the X-Men franchise.
Going, women with too much power must kill everyone because they can't handle it, which is why we need to put Emma Frost into the MCU as quickly as possible, because that is a woman with a lot of fucking power who is never out of control.
And so that Hannah Waddingham
we
can
were
have her
robbed
next role.
Of 20 years of Hannah Waddingham leading the MCU as Emma Frost. Xavier is dead. Emma and Scott take over the school. Emma runs shit. She's got that delicious love triangle with Jean. Jean realizes she don't need a man. It resolves. Emma Frost goes off to marry Tony Stark. Scott and Jean and Logan enter this weird polyamorous triad. It's a lovely 20-year arc. It's canon in the comics. It's canon. Cyclops and Wolverine and Jean are in this lovely throuple. It's delicious. Good for them.
Good for them. Jean is a god and a god needs a team. I'm 100% on your side here. Yes. Well, yes. As long as we're correcting the mistakes of huge, multinational billion-dollar corporations, Palpatine should not have come back from the dead in Star Wars. I would like to go fix it. Somehow Palpatine has returned.
Okay, I'm going to admit something
to you. What a
puke bag
of an idea.
The more that I am Trek over Wars.
Oh, I've been my whole life. I'm a lifelong Trekkie and a casual
Star Wars. There are two franchises that I should, by rights, be obsessed with, and they are Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. At best, they've both been a B- for me, personally. The best they've ever reached, in my opinion, is B-. I either feel like I'm not being told enough or being told too much. Either be a popcorn movie or be this, like, deep meditation. Yeah, it's never been,
epic.
It's never fit quite right. But then you get Mandalorian.
Which, yeah, they're capable of doing good work. They just choose not to a lot of the time. We are going
to
get...
You have to take it out of George Lucas' hands. You have to take it away from him. And you have to say, good boy, George. Nice universe you made there. Let me fix. I mean, the only reason people liked the original trilogy is because of his wife. The only reason anybody liked Tim Burton was because all the women that wrote the scripts.
As usual, pulling in the side in the backstage parts and making it always better. We got a question come in after we started recording that I would like to ask you, and then I'd like to end up on the witchy question, if that's all right. So the question that came in while we were recording is, how do you go about connecting with a solid readership for feedback and editing? Do you have any suggestions for that? I'm considering searching Discord for online writers.
Oh, I've been asked this a lot. And my advice to up-and-coming authors is make friends with other better authors.
100%.
That are farther along in their career and that are better and more talented than you and all of that. And then people are like, well, how? And I'm like, okay, so you stumble into them.
You have to go to things, even if it's online Zoom events. You just have to go to events. And I think what people are envisioning is they're trying to talk to some huge best-selling author. Like they're trying to buttonhook Michael Chabon on his way out of a speaking gig. And it's not that. You want to talk to somebody who's one or two levels beyond where you are.
No.
Not a huge superstar, because they're not going to do this with you, but somebody who just got their debut out or just sold their book or is like right where you're trying to be next. If you find a community of people and you're the most well-published or the most well-known or the most talented person there, you are in the wrong room. You need to be challenged by the people around you. So find people who can challenge you. Go to readings at bookstores, go to poetry events, there's all kinds of reader series in like every city in America. You'd be so surprised what you find out. Make friends with authors there, published and unpublished, people who are looking just like you're looking and people who are slightly ahead of you, and grow your own community at home.
There are two different groups here. Writers, if you are writing, you need writer friends. Once you've been published, you need author friends. Those are two different groups of people. If you are in the process of writing, you need people that are going to answer that frantic email, that are going to read your text, that are going to read your alpha draft, your beta draft. A lot of times, those cannot be your author friends because they are probably also very busy and they already have their own writer friends. And they're you're probably not going to be part of that group, at least for not a very long time.
It is really hard. on both sides of that. So once you make your way to the other side, once you are the author friend and you need other author friends, you realize that you have a different class of problems now. And you can't ever complain to your unpublished friends that you don't like the deal that you got, or that you don't like your PR, or that you got a bad book cover, because all they can hear is, I have a book deal. It's just you crowing about your book deal, and your problems are real, but you cannot take them there.
Because there's this weird jealousy thing that happens, and nobody thinks it's going to happen to them and their group, and their group is the best group, and it's all so great and different for you. I promise it's not. Or even if they're not jealous, they just don't understand why certain things are important to you.
Yeah, they can't imagine what it's like on the other side.
Like, aren't you just so grateful to have a book cover at all? Why do you care what color it is? I'm like, I do not think that you understand. I have been emailing about this frickin' salmon-colored cover for 6 months, and nobody's listening to me.
So you need a group of people who are your peers or are slightly farther ahead than you, always. Yes. Do not aim your critiques or your complaints downward.
Also, just generally speaking, stop airing your grievances on social media. Like your authorial behind the scenes, like the stuff that belongs in a group chat.
Once you're published, your group chat is your friend. Do not take your unvarnished opinions to the internet. Do not take your petty bickering. Do not take your, that person's not talented enough to warrant this big a contract. Only your group chat.
We all have those thoughts. We are not saints.
The safe place to talk about them, the safe place, is in a group chat where people have sworn never to take screenshots.
Yep.
Don't act like you weren't warned.
Live in those voice notes.
Voice notes are great. Voice notes are saving my life right now.
You need the people that are going to read your dirty drafts. You need the people that can sit there and say, listen, this is shit.
Yeah.
I like the things you said. I liked none of the words that you used to say it. And you need people that you can listen to that feedback from. You need to be able to surround yourself with people that you will actually listen to.
Who you respect, believe, who you know are qualified to give you feedback. Yeah. Yes. I'm not saying that, you know, more published people are better than you, but I am saying they are dealing with a bigger school of fish than you are.
Okay. What's the... Okay. Oh!
The witchy question. Yeah. So we're winding down to one of the longest nights of the year, on our way to longest night of the year.
The winter solstice, the longest night, the shortest day of the year. My saddest day.
Are you always saddest on the solstice? Do you hate the short days?
I am a summer child. The long, long, long days when sunset is not till 9:30. And I can just live outside and bake and be golden. And long days are great for somebody with anxiety. Because... I always have enough time, but now I have like 2 hours to get everything done. Not good. It's not good.
So you need your seasonal practices now more than ever. How do you like to celebrate on winter solstice?
I do try to fill the house with a lot of light. So every candle in the house that I can light, I light. All the little, you know, holiday lights that I can, as many strings of lights as I can. But I turn off all like the lamps. It's just... ambient lighting. So candles, garland, the tree, all of that. Fire in the fireplace, of course. Special desserts, whatever food feels good. I don't usually like go nuts with the menu for winter solstice, but usually something good and warming and delicious and comforting. That's usually when I do my annual rewatch of Hogfather.
Yes, Hogfather.
I have tried in different years to stay up all night to greet the sun.
Vigil, yeah.
I try so hard. I've tried different ways. I've tried to read all night because I was like, oh, some people read all night and then they get, you know, up in the morning. I've stayed up very late before and I probably will again. Just something about the night just asks you to stay up. I've never made it all the way.
Vigil's a lot easier when you're young and you don't have a job. Like, I have to be at work in the morning of the 22nd. Yeah.
Even if you work remotely, there's only so much that you can get away. You still have to roll out of your bed and crawl to your computer.
I don't want to take my job to work from home from my bedroom. It has invaded enough of my house.
I did take Friday off.
Good for you.
I am going to try to stay.
Try for Vigil. All right.
That is this year's goal, is to try to stay up. I don't know if it's going to work.
I like to greet the dawn. Like, I don't want to be up all night, but I'll get up in the morning to see the new sun.
Yeah. I try to get, but I'm usually up before the sunrise anyway, so that's usually pretty easy for me.
Dr. Eric Scott, who's been a previous guest of this podcast, he goes up to Monk's Mound outside of St. Louis, to where the ancient city of Cahokia was located, and he watches the sunrise there every year. I wish I was going to be in St. Louis because I would love to do it with him, but it's a great place to observe from.
Do you have any special foods? Anything that just says the season to you?
I usually make a pomander, which is, I know people have seen one, but they often don't know its name. It's where you press cloves into a fresh orange. Mm-hmm. You can do little designs. You can do like stripes and stars, and you hang it up with a ribbon. And it's like an old school air freshener, but it looks and smells very Christmassy. And I like that to be my little Yule craft. I also light all the candles and all the lights, not the big lights, but the cute lights all through the house. And I usually like to sing a couple of songs from that time of year. I don't even care if they're like Christian hymns, Christian songs. I like the spooky minor key We Three Kings, O Come Emmanuel stuff. Yeah.
Do you have any witchy Yuletide songs that are in your playlist?
There's an English Christmas song called In the Bleak Midwinter that I really like. And only the last like couple of verses are about Jesus. It's mostly about finding community in the darkest parts of the year and trying to figure out how to give something when almost everything is frozen and used up and you're trying to make it to spring. So I really love that one.
What are you looking forward to most in 2024? Do you have anything big coming in 2024?
I wish I did. I have a ton of work that I want my agent to sell. I hope to have big news in 2024.
You will. You will. The movie for Book of the Unnamed Midwife is going to finally get out of... those movie rights are going to get off a shelf somewhere. People are going to be looking for the next big franchise. We're not done with dystopia quite yet.
We're really not. It just keeps coming. So Midwife could absolutely get made. Yeah.
You're going to be seeing wooden bellies at the Comic-Con.
We're going to make one out of cardboard because it's a lot easier.
Oh, well, this has been so much fun.
Yes, this has been really a great talk. Thank you so much for having me.
I have enjoyed burning down 2023 with you. Real quick, what is just one thing that if you could speak it into existence right now and make it go away forever in 2023, what's that one thing? I'm going to give you a second to think, and I'm going to say rich 19-year-olds that live at home but make Fitstagram accounts that are like, if I can do it, why can't you, fatty?
Yeah.
Those I want all of those to disappear immediately off of the face of the earth. I would like a meteor to come only to those houses.
That seems fair. Yeah. I really like that. It feels really small and selfish not to say, you know, terribly bloody global conflict, because there are several wars that I would like to end this year. Today would be great, actually, just knock off before the holiday and not return in 2024. I've been so terrorized by the image of war and genocide in 2023. I cannot take it anymore.
Every morning, every single morning when I turn on the news, it's horrifying. And then, like, what do you and I do? What do we do? Yeah. What are we supposed to do other than, like, let's keep raising awareness.
Yeah, I feel really aware. Congrats, everybody. I'm really aware.
Very incredibly aware. And everybody, that you feel helpless and awful and terrible, which is kind of a running theme for 2023.
Let's leave feeling helpless in 2023.
Feeling helpless and awful and terrible in 2023. 2024 is when we are empowered. Love that. Meg Ellison, author of all of the best books, and writer of the best writing style that just folks, if you haven't read a Meg Ellison book yet, just go read Number One Fan, go read Fine Layla, go read the Book of the Unnamed Midwife and the Road to Nowhere trilogy, go read The Pill, go read her short story collection. I pray to anything that will listen to the tentacled beasts in the sea and the nameless things under the mountains. I pray to all of them that if I could one day just have a tenth of the gripping writing style that you have, because I hate you so much. No matter what you send me, I just open, I read a page, and then suddenly it's Thursday. And I'm like, what the hell happened?
I've read a lot of your unpublished fiction, Don, and I cannot wait until it's out in the world and people can tell you the same kind of things you're telling me.
Yeah, well, your lips to my agent's inbox.
Seriously, right?
All right, thank you so much. F2023.
Let's fuck it. Let's out of here.
That is going to do it here for both this episode and 2023 on Head on Fire. My thanks to my friend and guest, Meg Ellison. You can find her books wherever fine books are sold.
Anyways, quick reminder that I do not produce a show in January. I do a lot of things. I have a lot of projects. I have a lot of stuff up in the air, and I need to do just a few less things. So January is usually my time to chill on just a few of those projects so I can prioritize some other things. So, however, if you like the show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. And right now is a really good time to do that, because if you sign, like you can do like with Patreon, you can sign up and you could do like for the whole year for like $12, right? And you could just get the whole of 2024 and like all the extra content. And the thing is, there's probably going to be a lot of content because I've got a lot of books coming up and planned. And once that train gets going, there's going to be a lot of extra little stuff that's going to be sprinkled out there for my Patreon supporters and subscribers and stuff on all of the various things. However, if you don't have any like coin in your purse, I totally get it. There are a number of ways that you can help. You can share it with your friends on social media. You could also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, leave a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners just like you. If you hate the ads throughout the show, you can join the Patreon, patreon.com/headonfirepod. Or if you want to connect with me on social media, I am at headonfirepod everywhere. Thank you all so much for 2023. This has been a wild ride. I hope 2024 is even better for you and everybody that you consider family. Thank you all so much for tuning in and downloading. I'm going to go, but remember, never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.